This report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a litany of broken climate promises. It is a file of shame, cataloguing the empty pledges that put us firmly on track towards an unlivable world. We are on a fast track to climate disaster.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking today at the unveiling of the UN panel's big report on climate change. The report says that the world already has the solutions to avoid the widespread destruction that comes with a warming climate, but it needs to act a lot faster than countries are already promising to do, like in the next few years. Can we do it? Here to talk about this is Leah Stokes, energy policy researcher and professor at UC Santa Barbara. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you. So this report is supposed to be about solutions. So this is the third in a series of big reports. And it says the world has to act fast, very, very fast, but it can do that. It has the means to do that. What needs to happen by the end of this decade?
Well, scientists have been clear for many years now that we have to cut our carbon pollution by about half by 2030 if we want to have a chance to limit warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade. Those who may remember, we've already warmed the planet by more than one degree, and we're seeing those impacts all across California and really all across the world. So scientists are saying it's time for the governments of the world to act now and rapidly cut carbon pollution in half by 2030.
And so that translated 1.5 degrees Celsius is 2.7 degrees in Fahrenheit. And so that's in just less than 8 years. What happens if we don't do that? What does 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit look like?
Well, scientists remind us that there's no amount of warming that's safe or that's sort of beyond what's possible. What we want to do is limit warming. We want to do as much as we can, as fast as we can, to cut carbon pollution, because that's how we can avoid the worst impacts of climate change. There are parts of even our own state, such as Santa Barbara County, where I live, and Ventura County, just north of LA, where we've already seen warming of more than 2 degrees centigrade. So parts of the planet are warming even faster than the average. And that warming is, of course, bringing devastating impacts like this drought, this once in a 500 years drought, the horrible wildfires, the terrible heat waves. This is what 1 degrees of warming looks like across the planet. What is 2 or 3 degrees going to look like? We need to be moving a lot faster to roll out clean energy and climate solutions to avoid those catastrophic impacts.
Okay, so let's look at the solutions. The report says we can do this because we are developing clean energy at a much faster pace than had been anticipated. Is that good news? Sounds like it.
Yes, there's lots of good news in this report. There are some countries and regions that have begun to reduce carbon pollution. They've peaked, so to speak, and they're starting to come back down, even though the planet as a whole is still increasing its carbon pollution every year. Now, what can we be doing to speed that up? We can be deploying clean energy technology. That is things like solar and wind, as well as electric vehicles, public transit, electric bikes, even these cool things called heat pumps, which are these new efficient technologies that can heat and cool your homes. So we have all the technology that we need. And one cool thing that the report shows is that the costs of these technologies have been falling rapidly. So in many places, they're actually cheaper than fossil fuels. So we need our governments to be incentivizing people to be putting in these clean, efficient technologies every single time, for example, their furnace dies, or they need a new car, or, you know, they have decisions like that to make.
And so is that happening more on the local level than on national levels? As you mentioned, California is moving ahead with a lot of this technology, but then we've seen this kind of legislation falter in Washington, basically because of one or two senators are opposed to it.
Yes. Right now, there is a landmark piece of legislation ready to be voted on in the Senate. It used to be called Build Back Better. I don't know what it's called now, but the point is it is $555 billion in clean energy and climate investments. This package has already been passed by the House of Representatives last fall, and we're just waiting on the Senate to schedule a vote to get this bill across the finish line. You know, President Biden has been very clear. For example, last week when he gave a speech about the terrible situation in Ukraine and how Vladimir Putin is using oil and gas and fossil fuels to prop up his regime. And President Biden called on Congress to pass this $555 billion in clean energy and climate investments. We actually have the solution ready to go in Congress right now. We just need those Democratic senators to get it across the finish line.
And those are two standing in the way, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we've actually now heard comments from every single Democratic voting senator. Some of them are independents, technically, like Senator Bernie Sanders. But every single one of them, including Senator Manchin, have said that they are willing to pass these clean energy and climate investments. And so we need Majority Leader Schumer to step up, figure out where are the outstanding disagreements and get these investments over the finish line. Because the report from the scientists today could not be clearer. There is no time left to waste. If we want to cut carbon pollution by half by 2030, we need to pass this bill in Congress.
What about other countries? What are they doing? Countries like China and India.
Well, historically, the United States and other developed countries have put out the most carbon pollution. So when we think about why the planet has already warmed by 1 degree, it's overwhelmingly countries like the United States that are responsible for the situation we are in. However, in recent years, developing countries have pulled ahead and are currently polluting higher amounts. And so China right now is the number one global emitter, and India is also a major emitter. Now, China does have plans to begin to cut their carbon pollution. They have made pledges to, for example, peak the amount of carbon pollution, peak the amount of coal in the coming years. So that is hopeful. They need to be moving even faster. But, you know, it's not enough to say, oh, other countries are doing this. The reality is that the United States is the number one global polluter of all time when it comes to carbon.
What has the war in Ukraine done for this whole debate? Because on the one hand, it's taken the eye off the ball of this topic. People aren't really thinking or talking about it. They're thinking and talking about the war. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, we were talking about the global oil supply and cutting exports from Russia. Could that actually be a good thing in that it might push Germany and the other European countries to adopt cleaner energy faster?
Well, the war in Ukraine is nothing but a tragedy. It is absolutely devastating to see the genocide that is unfolding in that country right now. It has led to rising oil prices globally. This is why Americans are paying more at the pump to drive their cars, for example. So that is why President Biden gave a speech last week where he said he was going to use the Defense Production Act, which is this old law that comes from the 1950s. And it allows the president to say, hey, we're going to invest in a technology. So what he said was he's going to invest in critical minerals for batteries. These are really key things to build, for example, electric vehicles. And he also signaled that he may be moving forward on using the Defense Production Act for heat pumps, those technologies that you can buy right now to both heat and cool your home in a very clean way and very efficiently. So I think that this is actually beginning to bring more attention to the energy issue and to the climate investments in Congress. Because when we think about historically, when Congress has acted on our energy issues, has passed clean energy investments, it's actually happened during periods where the oil price is high, during energy crises. So we are in a moment right now where Congress needs to act. It needs to help Americans afford their energy bills by passing the $555 billion in clean energy and climate investments that have already passed the House of Representatives.
Leah, always great to speak with you. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me on.
Leah Stokes, she's an energy policy researcher at UC Santa Barbara. Coming up, why it took more than 100 years to pass a federal anti-lynching law. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I just signed into law the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act, making lynching a federal hate crime for the first time in American history.
President Biden last week signing a law that makes lynching a federal hate crime and punishable by up to 30 years in prison. The new law is named after Emmett Till, a 14-year-old boy who was kidnapped and lynched in 1955. But Biden says, half century later, lynchings are still happening.
But the law is not just about the past. It's about the present and our future as well. From the bullets in the back of Ahmaud Arbery to countless other acts of violence, countless victims known and unknown, the same racial hatred that drove the mob to hang a noose brought that mob carrying torches out of the fields of Charlottesville just a few years ago.
Well, it's taken more than a century to pass federal anti-lynching legislation. Similar attempts have failed hundreds of times. Joining us to talk about this is New York Times opinion columnist Jamelle Bouie. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, talk about that signing ceremony and that speech that the president gave. Kamala Harris was there when she was senator. She sponsored a bill, an anti-lynching bill that didn't pass. Senators Cory Booker and Congressman Bobby Rush also there. Tim Scott on the Republican side. So talk about that scene and what it was like to watch the president sign that piece of legislation.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I didn't actually watch the signing ceremony. I read the statement and read a bit of it afterwards, but I didn't really watch the signing ceremony, only because, you know, it's an important moment, but I wasn't necessarily certain that it was, you know, must see TV.
Mm-hmm. But his speech, what did that say to you?
You know, I thought it was a pretty standard issue speech about the signing of a bill. I thought that, you know, his comments on the history of lynching were well taken. So were Vice President Harris's. You know, I wrote about this bill, but I didn't necessarily write about the bill for its own sake, which I think is it's good enough, right, to pass a bill outlawing lynching. Mm-hmm. It is an historic occasion, given how many times the Congress has tried and failed to do this. I think that although you could make the case that lynching still happened today, they happened in a very different context than they did in the 50s, or really the age of lynching, which was the early part of the 20th century. You know, the if you're thinking about sort of the primary issues that face African Americans these days, I'm not certain I would put lynching at the top of the list as much as the bill, again, is as much as the law, right, is well taken. And it's a good thing that it's been signed. My interest in writing about this is less the bill itself and more sort of what the story of the effort to pass a lynching law says about the nature of American political institutions.
Mm, okay, well, let's talk about that then, because as we mentioned in the introduction, this has been an attempt that has gone on for more than 100 years, several hundred attempts at a piece of legislation that has failed. And you write about how this is really an illustration of what happens when a group of minority states actually bands together to prevent something that the national, the United States in a broader sense wants to get passed.
Right. I think when you think about the things that Americans tell themselves about their institutions, and I would call them sort of the myths they hold about their political institutions, one of the most potent ones is the idea that kind of the separated and federated nature of the American system, right? The fact that we have a Senate and a House, the fact that the states have so much authority, et cetera, that these things exist to protect quote unquote minorities. That's the language that we use. But minority doesn't minority as we tend to use it today, you know, means racial minorities, ethnic minorities, sexual minorities, so on and so forth. But minority in the sense of sort of political institutions really just means any faction, any group that isn't the majority of the population or isn't a sizable part of the population. And what the lynching, the story of the effort to pass a lynching bill, which begins in the early part of the 20th century with the Dyer Anti-Lynching Act of 1918, inspired by the East St. Louis riots of the previous year in 1917. What that story, I think, shows is the way that our system does protect minorities, but very often those minorities are what you might describe as like local bullies, right? Sort of powerful elites, powerful local or regional elites who have monopolized political power and have been able to carve out essentially protection from the federal government using the veto points and overlapping systems of power and control that we have in our political system. So in this case, right, it's the elites of the Jim Crow South who are the minorities that have been protected by our political institutions, and they're protected from a federal government that, you know, a majority of lawmakers in both chambers had mustered the votes to make lynching a federal crime.
Right. And so I guess the question is then why now? Why has that changed? Because the whole structure hasn't changed that much. I mean, you still see this play out in, let's say, in the filibuster, for example. But so why was this piece of legislation, why was it able to be signed now after so many previous failed attempts?
Right. Well, there's no longer, you know, there's no longer a the Jim Crow system no longer exists. There's no longer, you know, an entrenched segregationist minority in Congress. I mean, all these things have changed, right? The social dynamics of the United States have changed considerably since the 1960s. You know, it can change monumentally since the 1910s and 1920s. And so even with the current state, even with our institutions that we have, the fact that there's been this massive social sea change makes something like an anti-lynching bill possible. But, you know, it's worth saying, right, that the social basis for the kinds of mob violence that we saw in the early 20th century no longer exists either, right? And so we have this, the same forces that make an anti-lynching bill possible also in some sense make it a little redundant, because we're not really worried about local and state officials no longer prosecuting mob violence, no longer prosecuting the organizers of this kind of violence. Like, all of the concerns that necessitated an anti-lynching bill early in the 20th century no longer exist, and those concerns weren't simply the fact of lynching, but the fact that there was social support for that kind of violence that made it difficult for local and state authorities to prosecute it, even if they wanted to. And that's just no longer the case. But when it comes to forms of oppression or forms of hierarchy or forms of domination for which there remains social support, the American political system does protect those elites, those, you know, people at the top of whatever hierarchy who want to continue doing it. So the dynamic still exists, just not for lynching.
So give me an example of where it does still exist, in what capacity?
A good example that we're kind of living through right now is the fact that, you know, there are multiple states passing laws essentially targeting transgender Americans, in some cases targeting gay and lesbian Americans as well. And the federal government could pass a bill more or less sort of like amending the Civil Rights Act to outlaw discrimination on this basis. Bills like this have been circulating, one I believe has passed the House at some point in the past decade. But because of the filibuster, because of the nature of the Senate, in which every state has an equal say, and so, you know, the Republican Party, because it controls many more states than the Democratic Party, has this sort of built-in advantage in the Senate, the federal government probably can't act to do anything about these things, can't pass that legislation that would preclude states from pursuing their own attempts to burden these marginalized minorities. And so there's, I mean, right there you have I wouldn't say an analogous situation, but the same kind of dynamic happening in terms of the federal government's, you know, on its face power to stop these things, but the ways in which the system, the political system, makes it very difficult to exercise that power.
Hmm. Jamelle Bouie, New York Times opinion columnist. It's always great to have you. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here in California, in the wake of George Floyd's murder and the summer of racial unrest in 2020, the state passed a law that required corporate boards of publicly traded companies to diversify and include a member from a, quote, underrepresented community. That law, though, may be short-lived because on Friday, a judge here in L.A. found it unconstitutional. He didn't explain why, but we're going to try to find out by talking with our legal Loyola Law School professor, Jessica Levinson. Jessica, this was a one-page ruling. What did it say?
Not that much, other than that the law is not going to go into effect. So the group challenging the law said, we would like a permanent injunction. This was a question that was on summary judgment, meaning the judge himself, not a jury, was making decisions with respect to the law. And he said, yes, I'm granting that permanent, which is exactly what it sounds like, injunction, meaning this law, if my ruling stands, is not going into effect here.
All right. So who was bringing this case in the first place?
So this was a conservative organization called Judicial Watch, and they brought this particular case saying that it's unconstitutional under, and I think this is important to remember, California's law. So this is separate from a discussion that you and I have often about whether or not, for instance, certain laws violate the federal constitution. In this case, they said, this looks like a quota. And I'm looking at recent precedent in California, including a 2001 law. And this type of quota is not okay under California law. It violates anti-discrimination provisions. And it, you don't have a good enough reason based on your data. And even if there was a good enough reason, what they argued here and what the court believed is that the fit of the law, the means by which it was achieved, were too much of a mismatch.
So who does the law discriminate against, according to them?
So the idea is that the law had to prevent some discrimination. And the court said, well, and you asked me, who does it discriminate against? And I promise I'll get there. So the idea is that the law is preventing some discrimination. And the first problem here is that the court said, I'm not sure you prove that to me. I'm not sure that you prove that this law actually is preventing discrimination. You came forward with statistical evidence, but based on a 2001 California appellate court decision, you need more than just evidence. The state said, well, look, we've got testimony. We don't have a written opinion from the judge, but it doesn't look like the judge thought there was enough there. Then you asked me specifically, who does it discriminate against? So we get in our analysis to this question of, does the law include some people that it shouldn't and fail to include some people that it should? And that's where the judge asked this question of, well, why does this include, for instance, Asian Americans when they've been, by and large, this is a generalization, but economically successful? And the state had a response to that, but it was a really interesting interaction where you saw the judge saying, it's too broad and it's too narrow. It doesn't survive this heightened level of scrutiny that we need in California when we're talking about laws that would basically give a boost for people based on racial background or LGBTQ status.
So this sounds a lot like this law that California passed several years ago that requires women, or at least one woman, to be on a corporate board of a publicly traded company. And that has actually worked to put more women on corporate boards, as I understand it, that the share of seats held by women has practically doubled since then. But I understand that is also on track to be legally challenged.
Yes. And I remember you and I talked about this. I believe they just finished a 6-week trial back in March dealing with that law. I think it's the same group, Judicial Watch, that brought a challenge to that law. And we see very similar, although not identical, arguments basically being that you're not allowed to give this boost up to women, that it actually is a quota that would violate California state law. I don't think we have a ruling on that, but this is good news for challengers of that particular 2018 law.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk about a court ruling in Florida. A judge on Thursday blocked that state from enforcing part of its restrictive voting law. So this law had limited drop boxes, limited voter registration efforts, limited this idea that you could give people food and water while they waited online to vote. So the judge issued a pretty scathing 300-page ruling. And what did he say?
So the judge here said, Florida, you engaged in intentional discrimination, that I'm looking at 20 years of laws, and it can no longer just be a coincidence that these laws unduly burden Black voters and their ability to exercise their right to vote. And what he said is, because you've engaged in this egregious history of intentional discrimination, I'm subjecting you to something called preclearance, which means, Florida, if you want to make changes with to drop boxes or third-party voter registration organizations, or even these line-warming provisions that prevent people from giving water and food to people who are standing in line to vote, you have to check in with me first. That basically, Florida, I don't trust you.
So that's basically putting back in the Voting Rights Act preclearance formulation just for the one state, not for all the South.
Exactly, except that instead of checking in with a three-judge panel or with another federal government organization, it's this particular court. And there have been a lot of people after the Supreme Court gutted half of the Voting Rights Act in 2013 that have said, judges, use this preclearance more often. Try and put more states, counties, and cities that are engaging in problematic voter laws, that are passing these suppressive voter laws, put them under preclearance. And that's what this judge decided to do.
I imagine Florida will appeal.
I absolutely imagine Florida will appeal, and they'll appeal to the 11th Circuit, which is now a quite conservative leaning circuit. President Trump did a good job of nominating a number of people to that court. And I think that it's hard to find that the 11th Circuit would uphold this decision. It is a very detailed, methodical decision, but I don't see it standing once it's appealed to 11th Circuit. And then if it goes to the Supreme Court, this is a more conservative court than the court that gutted, again, half the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County back in 2013.
Jessica Levinson is a Loyola Law School professor and our regular legal here on Press Play. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new documentary explores how the COVID vaccines were developed.
If there's a hall for heroes in all of this, the people working on the vaccines will be among them.
That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, nearly 2 years ago, former President Trump stood in the White House Rose Garden and described what he called the most massive government undertaking since the Manhattan Project.
Operation Warp Speed will be simultaneously accelerating its manufacturing and manufacturing process. In other words, we're getting ready so that when we get the good word that we have the vaccine, we have the formula, we have what we need, we're ready to go, as opposed to taking years to gear up.
The race to get a vaccine had actually started months earlier in January of 2020, long before many of us even knew the coronavirus existed. Well, journalist and filmmaker David France's latest documentary tells the story of the vaccine's development and the politicization of it during the process, and of course, after the vaccines became available. His movie is called How to Survive a Pandemic. It's streaming on HBO Max, and David France joins me now. Welcome back.
Hey, it's so great to be here. Thanks.
Great to have you back. Well, we talked a while ago about your documentary about AIDS. It's called How to Survive a Plague, a very similar title. How did that film inform the making of this one?
Well, you know, the similarity has a lot to do with the people who are actually doing the work. When this pandemic first struck, I noticed that all of the people I had watched so many years ago in their scientific fight against HIV were the people stepping up again to take on this new viral pandemic. And in a way, it was interesting to watch what they had learned over these years, these many decades, and how more prepared they were than before to go to work and to find the formulas that were going to be necessary to give us some relief from this terrifying new reality that we found ourselves in. And the question, I think, was on everybody's lips was, will we survive this? Is this survivable? How many of us are going to get out of this? And I remember as a journalist covering the early days of HIV/AIDS, and also as a young gay man myself, that we had really no faith that we would survive it. And in both instances, it felt a science to do the right thing. And in that way, I felt personally called to the journalistic front to cover this plague as well.
Well, and you follow a journalist. He's sort of your avatar, I guess, this guy named John Cohen, mm-hmm. who writes for Science. And he also wrote a book about the search for the AIDS vaccine. Tell us a little bit about him. We're going to play a clip of tape of him just to get a sense of who he is. But why don't you first tell us who he is?
John Cohen is one of the renowned journalists covering HIV/AIDS, and he is unmatched in his reporting on the vaccine world. I started, you know, in the early days of the pandemic, not working on a film, but just obsessing personally about the vaccine. Where will it come from? Will it be successful? Do we trust the approaches that people are taking? And I turned to John for my own personal solace, and I recognized how clued in he was in a way that would allow us to see this development before anybody else.
Right. So you're a kind of a fly on the wall. You're in his house as he's making these phone calls to top officials. And let's just play one where he's talking to Dr. Paul Offit, who's on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee.
I just think we're on so many levels. We all have exactly the same goal. Get me a safe and effective vaccine as quickly as possible. We're just scared that science will be steamrolled.
So I guess scared that Trump and the Trump administration would steamroll science. Is that what he's talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it was very clear to everybody that there was an incredible chaos attending to the early weeks and months of the pandemic. It was unparalleled. Nobody had ever had to withstand that kind of pressure in those areas before. So the question was, could they withstand it?
Well, it's pretty incredible that a vaccine was developed in a year.
It is, yeah.
Less than a year.
Exactly.
Does the Trump administration deserve any credit for that?
They deserve a lot of credit. Operation Warp Speed was a very interesting way to corral the treasury of the country and the manufacturers of in Big Pharma and elsewhere, and to bring them on this kind of simultaneous course with the developers of the vaccines. What was accomplished in this case was to remove probably 2 or 3 years from the estimation of how long it would take to bring those vaccines into people's arms, and to bring that down to 11 months for the green light to manufacture, just a few days after that before vaccines were being shipped. And then the real bumpy road comes in trying to get the vaccines out to the world at large.
I want to talk a little bit about the FDA and the approval process. It has withstood a lot of criticism for its slow approval process. They seem to be behind when it comes to, for example, approving the booster shot, getting that online in time to prevent the Omicron surge. And it has been criticized for not approving at-home COVID tests quickly enough. What is your sense in terms of how quickly the FDA acted? Because, you know, as we said, there was a vaccine within 11 months, so it did act seemingly quickly when it came to the original vaccine.
I was embedded in the FDA's vaccine division, and they have been remarkably nimble, I think, in their ability to review the data and the scientific literature on each of the candidates as they come forward. I know that people were working around the clock in ways that they had never worked before. If there's a hall for heroes in all of this, the people working on the vaccines will be among them.
But do you see any parallels at all with how slow the government acted when it came to approving AIDS drugs like AZT to this pandemic?
Actually, there is a correlation, but the correlation shows us how much the system had been reformed by AIDS and AIDS activism. And I think that these very scientists that we see at the front today are hardened into this activist stance themselves by their experience in HIV and AIDS. They came out of the gate in January and February of 2020 knowing that they were called upon by this new pandemic to behave in superhuman ways, and they really did do it. And I think that there's only praise for the work that they were able to accomplish, even knowing that they were just as frightened as we were about going out and going to the lab and working with the virus before anyone really understood its nature. And they did that. They took that on as activists, and that was really impressive to watch.
Well, speaking of heroes, there's a character in your film who can only be described as such. He is a priest in Pittsburgh. He serves a very poor, predominantly Black community. His name is Paul Abernathy. And once the vaccine becomes available, he's trying to convince skeptical people in the community to take it. And here is a clip of him doing that.
Would you get the COVID vaccine?
You won't?
No.
Oh, no. You wouldn't take it?
The sooner that we talk about vaccine, the more time people have to warm up to the idea, to work through their own issues until they have the comfort they need to really get this.
I don't know what it is. I don't have corona, so I don't know. So I try to stay away from people who have it, so that's I don't good. Have to worry about a vaccine.
Okay.
When people say Black folks don't trust because of Tuskegee, yes, Tuskegee was horrible. It's also not only about Tuskegee.
Would you consider taking the vaccine?
Oh, no, I don't want to take it.
I don't know, I would never say, I just, I'm not going to take it.
Okay.
Would you read some information about it?
Oh, yes, I will.
Well, I think, because that'd be a great start.
Okay.
So he's really doing a Herculean job there. He's going door to door, talks to them at where they are, and tries to convince them using what he uses the Bible in certain circumstances. What was his winning argument?
It wasn't so much that he had a winning argument, it's that he understood what was troubling the people in his community. And so much about a vaccine hesitancy is not well understood. There's so much we have to learn about how to talk about science to people for whom science offers only this major benefit, but who have somehow over the years grown increasingly suspicious of science and those who practice it.
Right, and it's different arguments or different techniques or different ways of speaking with different groups of people that we need to employ. It's not just one public service announcement.
Absolutely.
Because the motivations for not taking it with this group of people might be different than the motivations of a MAGA crowd, right, who sees it more as a way to rebel against Joe Biden.
Absolutely. Totally different formulation. The origin is totally different. And the way to untangle that kind of thinking has got to be different.
So is that surprising to the scientists and to people that you profile in the movie, to John Cohen, for example, that that's really where the battle is? It's not in coming up with a vaccine that works. It's in convincing people to take it.
It's and or making it available to them.
Yeah.
So those are the two barriers to an effective vaccination campaign. From the very beginning, people were saying to me, look, if you want to see how this is going to play out, you have to watch not just the vaccine development, because A vaccine is not a vaccination. And only once it becomes a vaccination, liquid in a syringe emptied into an arm, only then is it doing the work of the science. And there are so many barriers between the manufacturing process and the arm that are still unaddressed. I think everybody that was on the front lines of this knew that the public health system had been put on a starvation diet over the last decades. I think there were some surprising aspects to it, and that's the way the radical right wing embraced hesitancy and skepticism about science. I think the way that that impacted the rollout in so many countries was really baffling. And in this country, and you see it in the film, people are approached by public health officials, and they say, well, the hesitant people say, well, they wouldn't do it because Trump wouldn't do it. Well, the rise in the kind of pro-Trump, anti-vax segment of society was a startling one, given that it was probably the most remarkable achievement of the Trump administration, that he was able to corral government and business in an all-of-society approach, that the people who are the most ardent of his followers would find suspicion in the outcome is really surprising.
Yeah. And the fact that he did get it, and he did urge people to get vaccinated.
Right.
And then some people turned on him for saying that.
Right, exactly. And the people we quote in the film say, no, he didn't get it. He wouldn't take it. And, you know, remember, he took his in secret. You know, unlike the many political leaders in the world, he didn't sit in front of a camera and roll up his sleeve. He took a couple of shots in some room in the East Wing of the White House, and then never said anything about it, not for months. And that certainly had an impact on his followers.
However, I wonder if he had done that, if people would have said, oh, that's faked footage.
Maybe. I know. Yeah, there are many documentaries to be made about how the human mind deceives itself in important ways.
Well, David, it's a fascinating look at the behind-the-scenes development of the vaccine and all the issues surrounding it. Thank you so much.
Oh, man, thank you so much for having me on to talk about it.
My pleasure. That's David France. His new documentary is called How to Survive a Pandemic. You can stream it on HBO Max. Last night, we had a conflict-free award show. Coming up, we will recap the Grammys next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The musician John Batiste took home the award for Album of the Year at last night's Grammys. When I move my body to- The award show was held in Las Vegas for the first time. It was hosted by Trevor Noah of The Daily Show. And notably, there was not a slap.
We're going to be dancing. We're going to be singing. We're going to be keeping people's names out of our mouths. And we're going to be giving out awards all throughout the night.
All right. Here with a recap of those awards is Andrea Dominik. She's a reporter and producer here at KCRW. Hi there.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay. Not a slap, but some great performances. What was your assessment of the show?
Right. Yeah. We had at best a couple of gentle slapping jokes from Trevor Noah and Questlove, which I think were both expected and kind of good for breaking that ice just a week after the Oscars.
Yeah.
You know, the show was fine. It went off without a hitch. And maybe that's kind of like all you can hope for in today's tumultuous award show climate. This year, it was certainly felt all about putting the big back in music's biggest night. And they really kind of leaned into a very pop forward lineup. You know, at the beginning of the show, Trevor Noah had called it, he said, this is going to be a concert where they're giving out awards. And that was definitely true. They gave out just 9 awards over the course of a 3.5-hour telecast.
Huh.
It felt like they were very much making a play for showing and not tallying, which I think overall was pretty successful as far as not having too much bloat and not having too many kind of awkward or cringy moments. One nice thing was they even had performances from some of the traditionally untelevised smaller categories like Best Bluegrass and like Christian Gospel. And it felt cool to include those and get a peek into those worlds. There were also some of the more behind-the-scenes music industry workers, like touring managers and costume heads and production designers presenting their bosses before their performances, which was a nice nod to what the industry has been through over the past 2 years.
Yeah. Okay, so we mentioned Jon Batiste in the intro there. He won 5 Grammys, including Album of the Year, and then also Grammy favorites Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak, as the band Silk Sonic won 4 Grammys, including Song of the Year and Record of the Year. So what do you make of all of that? As you say, it seems a pretty, I guess, pop-forward selection.
Yeah, it was, I guess, Jon Batiste was surprising only in that, you know, he was not necessarily somebody who was a giant star. You know, you think of someone like Billie Eilish coming to the Grammys a couple years ago and just sweeping it. And that was, that felt like a kind of real touchstone moment for an intersection with the Academy and the actual pulse of popular music. Jon Batiste, you know, only had a handful of reviews for that album. I had heard of him, but that was about sort of the extent of it. And, you know, his album, I think, had only peaked at number 86 on the Billboard Top 200 chart. So this definitely sort of felt like the Grammys kind of reverting to the older days when it was just kind of by the industry, for the industry, and maybe a little bit more out of touch with kind of the more dynamic trends of the music industry. Mm-hmm. But he was last night's big sweep.
Well, the Grammys are never known for being, you know, non-mainstream, shall we say.
Right.
It's pretty much the mainstream event for the music industry. Also, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, spoke via a video appearance. And here is a bit of what he had to say.
Our musicians wear body armor instead of tuxedo. They sing to the wounded in hospitals, even to those who can't hear them. But the music will break through anyway.
What was the reaction to him, and what did he want from the people in the audience and from the people watching?
Right. That was definitely, if there was any kind of big surprise moment at the Grammys last night, that was it, especially given the fact that, you know, there had been discussion about him wanting to appear on the Oscars telecast. I think Amy Schumer wanted him on the Oscars telecast, but ultimately the Academy said no. You know, and there's a longstanding tradition of a kind of separation of church and state with award shows, right? And this shattered that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, maybe this was about it being a time to lean in rather than escape. Award shows are traditionally a time for escapism. And last night's Grammys, besides Zelensky's speech, was very much about escapism. So what did he want from it? I think he doesn't want the situation in Ukraine to become normalized, to fall into mm-hmm. the news cycle. I mean, I think there's also cases to be made. Is this getting a little bit too close to the bone with involving political asks in something that has been historically apolitical? I don't know. We'll let Twitter duke that out.
Hmm. And speaking of solemn, the band, the Foo Fighters, were supposed to perform, but they're mourning the recent death of the drummer, Taylor Hawkins. Was there a remembrance of him during the show?
There was. It was actually perhaps a bit more abbreviated and subdued than I had expected. There was basically a montage tribute to him at the top of their In Memoriam segment. No in-person appearance from them or any other kind of particular words. And I think it probably was just too recent and a bit too close for home for anything more.
Okay. Well, on a more positive note, let's talk about Olivia Rodrigo. She won 3 Grammys, including Best New Artist, and here's a bit of her performance of her song, Driver's License. So, any surprise that she won Best New Artist, along with Best Pop Solo Performance and Best Pop Solo Album?
Absolutely no surprise there. You know, she's sort of being touted as like the next big sort of alt-pop ingenue and the next sort of rising star in the wake of folks like Billie Eilish. I would say that the only surprise there is that, you know, her much predicted big night did not quite come to pass because she didn't sweep all of the awards that she was expected to. You know, her song Driver's License lost to both Record and Song of the Year, and that was lost to Silk Sonic. And also her album Sour, which was a big expected frontrunner for Album of the Year, of course, lost that to Jon Batiste.
Oh, okay. All right, so unrelated to the Grammys, but related to pop music, Kanye West says he's pulling out of headlining at Coachella. Why is he doing this?
Why he's doing it is kind of anyone's guess. This comes on the heels of a slate of behavior that included him getting banned from Instagram, you know, making some controversial comments about his ex Kim Kardashian and his family, and also his promises to include Travis Scott in his performance at Coachella. Now, Travis Scott was originally scheduled to be a headliner this year until fans had petitioned for him to not perform. But yeah, this is definitely going to imagine a big headache for the Coachella organizers to have to slot in a third performer. Maybe we'll see Rage Against the Machine come back. They were originally scheduled to play that day in 2020 when that festival was canceled. So we'll see what they make of it.
All right, Andrea Dominik, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Andrea is a reporter and producer here at KCRW. All right, before we go, we are interviewing the top candidates for LA mayor. And next up is Los Angeles City Councilman Kevin DeLeon. And we want to hear from you. What do you want us to ask him? Tweet us your questions at KCRW Press Play, and we may ask your question on the air. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.